Hey, Internet, he's John. I'm Mark. This is the Enthusiasticast, the web show where we endorse one awesome book. This week, special guest Peter Derbyshire will endorse Derek McCormick's The Haunted Hillbilly. Peter is the author of The Warhol Gang and I believe The Promise. Is that right, Peter?
Please.
Please.
Please. And that was from 2002, which I believe you just re-released as an e-book. Is that right?
I did, yeah. I jumped on the whole ebook craze.
So, can you just, your bio, it ranges a fair bit, right? Like, you did your first novel in 2002. You also have, like, this connection to the Book Ninja or something? So,
yeah. George Murray and I started Book Ninja together back when he was living in New York, and we'd been part of the scene in Toronto. And then we all split up and moved across. He moved down to New York. I moved to Vancouver. Some other friends moved all over. And so we created Book Ninja as a way to sort of keep in touch and just talk about, you know, literary stories. And then it kind of grew from there. And George was running it himself for, you know, last, 4 or 5 years. Cause I didn't have time to do it anymore. I was just too busy with, you know, life, but, yeah, it's good times.
So were you, had you published Please at that point?
I think so, yeah. I believe it was already out, yeah.
Okay, so The Warhol Gang is your second novel. Mm-hmm. What is that about?
It's about a guy codenamed Trotsky who works for a neuromarketing focus group where they lock him into MRI pods and bombard his mind with holograms of potential ads. And so they monitor his brain. They scan his brain while he's in this pod to see how he reacts to potential products. He starts to go crazy, starts seeing these products in real life, hallucinating them, goes to accident scenes at night because they're the only thing real he can find, being close to dead people or dying people. It's the most genuine experience he can have. At one of the accidents, he meets a woman who fakes accidents for insurance money. Although she actually secretly wants to be a movie star of security camera videos, and she drags him into an underground resistance movement that actually lives underneath the mall and resists the mall, and then things get weird.
So I read somewhere that you were like, oh yeah, people are calling the Warhol Gang sci-fi, and I consider it a contemporary story, right?
Yeah. It's been called sci-fi a couple of times, and it's not quite contemporary because I do sort of project a little, but it's kind of like I was going for the headlines of tomorrow as opposed to the headlines of, you know, 2020. So everything in it has sort of got some basis in reality, like neuromarketing does exist. I mean, they do actually do this. They do scan people's minds and see how they react to products, although it's a new field. So I just kind of, you know, extrapolated a bit and tried to set it just a bit in the future. But, you know, the future, of course, is always far weirder than reality. So I think it's now become an alternate history.
I found it read more contemporary as you went along. Like, as I was, the neuromarketing is introduced, you know, right off the bat. And yeah. I didn't know about that at the time. And so it feels very sci-fi. But then as you're reading it, nothing else really that gets introduced is, you know, out of the realms of reality of the present day. And so sort of by about 2/3, you're like, this isn't sci-fi at all, and which is actually, it's a neat thing to realize late in the book because it kind of recasts everything that you've read up to that point.
Yeah, and I wasn't ever going for the sci-fi thing. I mean, I had to put the neuromarketing in at the beginning just structurally, but I didn't want people to think, you know, this is some sort of Blade Runner world. I mean, I did actually want them to go, oh, yeah, this is my fucking IKEA world, you know, and go with that.
So, the Trotsky character is, as you say, a bit of a seeker, but, you know, as a kind of schizoid persona, like if you were to be his psychiatrist and diagnose his condition, what is he afflicted by exactly?
Well, you know, the easy answer is advertising, because that's, you know, so much of the book is him trying to grapple with these imaginary products. But I think that's the easy answer. To me, the advertising stuff is just a symptom. What he's really sort of afflicted with, if you want to use that, is the future. And I was sort of struck while I was writing this book. And I mean, you know, the crack I just made about being an alternate history is, you know, only partially comic, because I think that we're having a real struggle keeping up with the future. We're living in this age of just such technological innovation and social innovation and change that it's almost happening too quick for us to grasp, let alone keep up with. And I think that's sort of there in the book. He's constantly sort of bombarded with this change, and he can't grab a hold of it and steady himself. It just keeps happening, quicker and quicker.
I actually want to follow up on that a little bit, because, like, as you said, he just has, because of the life that he's living, the modern life, he just has this incredible difficulty connecting with people. So there's almost an element of sociopathy in his behavior. He's a sympathetic character, and yet he does a lot of unsympathetic things. And I was just wondering, was that something that you thought a lot about when you were writing the character? Was that something that you had difficulty with? Because obviously, as your narrator, you want him to remain sympathetic, or at least engaging.
Yeah, I wanted to remain engaging. I actually don't care about the sympathy. And I've been called in reviews in the past, numerous things, but amoral is one that keeps coming up. And in fact, somebody actually used it as a compliment the other day, which I was kind of relieved at. It was the first time somebody complimented me by using the word immoral. With Please, I ran into the same sort of issue when it came to the critical reception of people were struggling to get a handle on the narrator and how to approach him, because, in both these books, yeah, they do some pretty unpleasant things. But I kind of approach it from, I'm not trying to create a likable character. I'm trying to create an everyman sort of character and put him in, the everyday situation of tomorrow and see what interesting ways in which that character breaks. And that's what I think I did with the Warhol gang. I mean, I set out to break him, right? And so,
well, you broke him real fucking good.
But everybody's broken. I mean, it's one of the things that came up with in the editing process. My editors at HarperCollins were asking the same question, like, how do we approach him? And sort of came up, the question was, is this a dystopia? Is he the one sort of odd person out? Is he the one person who understands the truth? And it did force me to sort of focus my attention a bit more in the editing process, and it made me realize that, no, what I really wanted was he is really an everyman. Like, everybody in the book is broken in their own way. I choose to sort of tell it through Trotsky's viewpoint. And of course, his name isn't even Trotsky. We never learn his name, because we're not allowed to learn his name in the book, because of the company that he works for. So he doesn't even have his own identity. Nobody does.
Nobody does, yeah.
But in terms of, like, the sociopathy that John mentioned, like, you go there and then you back away. And that was kind of my similar reading of the violence in the book. Like, it never – it was ever present but was never perverse, if that's fair. I don't know.
That's fair, yeah.
So, you know, writing violence is really hard. And I was just like, okay, was that on purpose, or was you just weren't interested in that? Like, I wasn't sure.
No, I actually sound funny, but I quite like writing violence, and I'm perhaps more comfortable writing violence. The book that I'm working on right now is extremely violent, and I'm having a blast, and it's coming out very smoothly. What I didn't want a whole lot of in the Warhol gang was, shootouts and the sort of typical kind of violence of, I guess, that traditional type of violence. I really wanted these people to be victims of the system, for, lack of a better word, right? Like, the whole society they live in. So I think everybody in the book does actually meet with violence, but it's always a very impersonal kind of violence and almost inhuman. One of my favorite scenes in the book is there's a scene where Trotsky and another member of the resistance are sent out on a mission to steal this courier truck, and they steal it, and they end up driving into what's essentially a giant garbage room. It's this giant garbage pit. They actually go over the edge and they go into this crash into this garbage pit, and it's sort of never ending, right? It has no bottom, and Trotsky manages to get out, but the other guy sinks into it. And he just slowly gets swallowed up by all of these discarded and broken products, and disappears from sight and disappears from the narrative. And the last we see from him is he calls Trotsky on a cell phone, you know, sort of pleading for help as he's sinking down in this sea of products. And so everybody, I think, encounters that type of violence in the book. It's, you know, it's the violence of the mall, essentially.
I loved Trotsky's line at that point where he's the guy's pleading for help, and he's just like, well, maybe when you get to the bottom, you can walk out.
Yeah, it's my favorite part of the book.
it was a great scene.
Thanks.
Just to follow up on that, to me, reading the book, there was a very distinct prose style to the writing. A lot of short sentences, which I found to be very propulsive. It was this weird thing. It was very dense, but it was very quick at the same time,
right.
Which you don't often get. It's usually one or the other. And I was just wondering, was that a deliberate choice on your part? Is that just the way you write, or was it something that you settled on for this book because it was part of how you wanted to tell the story?
I think it's a little both. I do tend to write sort of short sentences and you know, minimalist style, I guess, for lack of a better word. I mean, I wouldn't really associate myself with, you know, the guys, you know, like you know, Carver and Hemingway and that. But, I mean, I do write that sort of stripped-down sentence. When it came to the sort of structure, I had to do a lot of work because, you know, the book is broken down into scenes. And I think a lot of the sort of propulsion of the book comes from that structure. It's very filmic. There's not chapters. And when I first started writing the book, I was trying to write it in chapters and I couldn't do it. I had massive writer's block. And it took me years basically to get over. I kept doing sort of false starts on the book and trying it in different approaches. And it was only when I started writing in film scenes that the book actually came out, and I think that's where it has a lot of the sort of momentum is that, you know, every sort of section is only, you know, 1-2 pages long sort of tops, and they're all sort of focused on a moment of action or a moment of you know, some sort of mental change or conflict for him. Sorry,
has there been any discussion of a film adaptation?
Well, there's some people have approached the agency, but it's sort of all up in the air at this point. So, as it always is.
Well, it's funny because, you know, you talk about it being contemporary, you being it in the future. And I kept on thinking of Videodrome, you know, 1983 Reaganomics, right?
Right.
And so I was just wondering, like, okay, you know, I spotted a ton of kind of potential influences in the story, and I'm, you know, some were more overt than others. So what ones would you cop to, and like, what were by accident?
Well, a lot of it is less literary and even less film and more. A lot of the research I did, not even research really, was I spent a lot of time just browsing YouTube and hitting related links on things and seeing where they took me.
Evelyn McHale or whatever who you reference, right?
Pardon me?
You reference, I believe her name is Evelyn McHale.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The Warhol, Empire Street Building jumper.
Yeah, and she jumped off and it was one of these things I stumbled across by accident after I had started writing the book and I wrote her in because it was such a powerful thing. It's this woman who jumped off, I think it was the Empire State Building and crashed onto this car and killed herself. It was, it was a jilted love sort of thing. And somebody happened on the scene and took a photo of it. And of course, it's a stunningly beautiful photo of this woman lying dead on this crushed car, right? And you know, she became famous, right? She became famous in her death. And that's the whole thing that Holiday, his love interest, Trotsky's love interest in the book has, is she realizes at a certain point she's done everything right. She wants to be a movie star. And she can't get anything other than extra shots and commercials. And so she realizes she has to do something dramatic like this. You know, she has to basically obliterate herself and become famous that way. So I found things like that. I found things, you know, like all the neuromarketing and I listen to a lot of advertising podcasts and read advertising magazines and stuff. And I find that is an incredible influence because, you know, advertisers are always coming up with insane new ways to just work your mind and, you know, hit at those spots you didn't even know were there. And then there was just weird subculture stuff like, well, one day I was just surfing and I came across this thing on YouTube of gunsight porn. that was, you know, Apache attack helicopters when they go into training missions down in the States. They'll sometimes use their cameras to spy on people having sex in their yards and, you know, out on boats and stuff like that. And then they load these videos up to YouTube, and suddenly these videos of people having sex through gun sites are you know, going viral. And it was just – it was stuff like that. That was – those were my real influences. It was just this sort of insanity of our contemporary world. When it comes to literary influences, I mean, the big one would be Catch-22 by Joseph Heller, which most people don't recognize, but I would say is a huge influence on this book.
Well, it's a really fantastic read, and I would really recommend it to anybody. I wasn't familiar with the book at all. Mark brought it to my attention, and I'm so glad he did, because I just had a whale of a time with it. I think it's excellent.
Awesome.
So speaking of excellent books, though, can you tell us about Derek McCormick's Haunted Hillbilly, which is a fantastic title.
And it's a fantastic book. And his style is even sort of more stripped down than mine. So I think there's a natural affinity for me there. I mean, I totally look up to him as a writer for what he's able to do with just a minimum of language. So Haunted Hillbilly is about a fictional Hank Williams who plays at the Grand Ole Opry, and his fictional tailor Nudie, who is a vampire, who designs Hank's suits, makes him famous, and sort of sucks him dry in a number of different ways. And there's a few other characters. There's Hank's wife, Audrey. But it's really sort of told from Hank's perspective and Nudie's perspective. Very slim little book. You know, it's probably really a novella, perhaps even a long short story, but a total gem of a standalone book. And it actually comes in multiple forms. So I have the sort of conventional book, but I've also got a smaller version of it called, I believe, Western Suit. That comes in this little suede booklet that's been hand designed in a shirt pattern envelope, and it also comes with a shirt pattern, so reflecting the tailor character in the book. And it's just this beautiful little it's a beautiful little fetish object is what it is.
Is that McCormick have a number of books, or is this his first book? What's his catalog like?
He's got a bunch, and catalog is actually a good term. He's got one book that's called Wish Book, a catalog of stories. His first one was Dark Rides, and it was a little more conventional, and I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just he's grown so much as a writer. Dark Rides sort of featured a young man in sort of, I don't know, 1950s, I'm guessing, small town Ontario. I constantly kind of read it as being taking place in Peterborough. Right. And it kind of inserts himself kind of puts this gay, dark character into the sort of pastoral landscape of you know, Canada, and just burns it down. Like the first story, Dark Rides, is a collection of linked short stories. And the first story in it, literally, it's these two young guys fooling around in the back of a barn, as, you know, young guys in Peterborough will do, and they start a fire and burn the place down. And it's, you know, there's never really any cause for the fire, except for maybe, you know, just their lovemaking. And so the very first thing, you know, you read of him is him burning down Can Lit, essentially, right?
Right.
Putting this really nasty character into it. But it's not the typical sort of redemptive. You know, let's find a voice for the previously silenced, you know, ethnic group or sexual identity group or whatever it is. Because with Derek's work, it's if you think my characters were sort of difficult to find sympathy for, his are extremely difficult, because his narrators are very, very nasty in a way that's absolutely delightful, and very, very perverse in a way that's absolutely delightful. And you can't sort of, you can never side with them, because they're just, they're vicious and, at times bordering on sexual predators. But in a way that is always told just absolutely beautifully. and in a way that always has you sort of on side with them. Like, he's a very, very skilled writer.
Well, the trick to making bad people sympathetic is to give them even worse people to play off, right? So,
yeah, but it's not really the case. Like in the Haunted Hill trilogy,
they're just awful people and they fuck with saints.
Like with Dark Rides, it's like, okay, it's the young guy in the Peterborough town, right? And then, you know, he actually takes that same guy basically in Haunted Hill Billy and turns him into a vampire, right? He just, you know, runs with that sort of viciousness in the character. And I think in Dark Rides, and even in Wish Book, where this same type of narrator works at a department store, there's the sort of restraint to that, that viciousness and that predation on the part of these guys and the sort of, you know, the depravity they engage in. And when he hits the Haunted Hillbilly and actually makes the character Nudie a vampire instead of being you know, human being, there's no more restraint, and he just lets loose, and so Nudie does all sorts of horrible things. He basically infects Hank Williams' wife with a clap. He has his enemies destroyed by the vampire bat swarms, and he makes things for Hank Williams' suit out of the bones of people he hires, and then, you know, involves them in accidents so he can, you know, basically disassemble their bodies and make fashion suits out of them. It's wonderful stuff. Wonderful.
I'm sold. I mean, I love vampires, and I usually at least once a year, you know, around the fall, around Halloween, you know, I try to delve into some horror fiction. So I think this is my book for 2011. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's stunning.
Peter, I can't thank you enough for being on the show.
Thank you.
It's been fantastic. Is there anything that you'd like to tell us about work that you've got upcoming, places people can find you on the web, anything like that?
Yeah, you can find me at peterdarbyshire.com. I'm also at Twitter, Peter Darbyshire, and on Facebook. You mentioned earlier, I put my first book, Please, out as released it as an ebook. So you can find that on Kindle and Kobo and iBookstore and all that. And then I'm just plugging away on the new stuff.
Awesome. You had a post the other day. You have a new book called The Apocalypse Corpse.
That's right, yeah.
And cool. It's going well?
It's going very well. It's I think because I'm not restraining myself when it comes to the violence, and it's just been a blast to write. I started at January 1st, and I'm about 250, 270, something like that, pages in, and be around 300 pages. So yeah, I'll probably be finished it within a month.
That's amazing. Well, yeah. That's great news, because I'm gonna head back for the first book, and then hopefully that'll hold me until the third one comes along.
Great.
So thank you again for coming on the show. And for our listeners, you can find more episodes of The Enthusiasticast at enthusiasticast.com. Please leave us a comment there. We recently heard from new commenters, Tom at thomaslickford.com and Juanita Hernandez, as well as regulars like Jen Twist, Nathan House, who is Nathan M. House on Twitter, and Ash from English Major Junk Food. Ash also put up a nice post about us on her blog, so thank you for that, Ash. Now, Mark is an emotional rock, but I am a fragile creature of delicate ego, so obviously that lifts my spirits greatly. To help new listeners find us, please consider leaving a comment in iTunes if you haven't already. And until next week, I'm John.
And I'm Mark.
Thanks for listening.
Cheers. Eagle or whatever, you were proofreader at Harlequin.
Yeah, I was proofreader at Harlequin, but they do the Gold Eagle books.
So were you doing romance? Like, were you reading romance?
I was probably like 90% romance, but just because of the numbers, you know, they churn out a lot more romance in the Mac Bolan books. But I was the guy who did the Mac Bolan books as well. There was me and one other guy, and then he quit, and the women didn't want to read, you know, Mac Bolan, so I got to read them all.
So did you actually read the romance novels as well, or was it just the Mac Bolan?
Oh no! Like I've read in my lifetime, man. I've read thousands of romance novels.
Oh my god!
And thousands of Mac Bolans.
Does that so, work you in a significant way?
Well, I just started viewing the Mac Bolans as romances, to be honest with you, because I think they're these extremely homoerotic books. you know, it's like Mac's always running around with some sawed-off weapon or another. You know, spurting hot lead into the bodies of the hard men, because the bad guys are always called hard men. you know, like.
So Matt Bolin is the Dumbledore of the semi-automatic world. It's just like unspoken that he's actually totally gay.
Yeah, and of course at this point he's a crazed senior citizen on top of it because he's been doing this since Vietnam, right?
So is it true? Is it true that Harlequin proofreaders have like a listserv that they share of ridiculous like descriptions of the act?
Oh, well, we didn't have a listserv when I was there because that was back in, what was it, 97, but we had a hard copy, we had print copies, and we had a little bulletin board we'd put stuff on, and usually it was sort of, you know, ridiculous typos, but then sometimes it was like just insane lines, yeah. So I remember my favorite typo ever was, he panted heavily in her rear.
Well, of course he did. Come on.
And it was one of those moments where you think, oh, I should leave that. And then, yeah, but we had the great line. Because, I mean, the thing about the Harlequins is they're very sort of basic narratives, right? Like, I mean, they're not getting fancy with the language. It's he walked across the room. He grabbed her, you know, by the hair, and he gave her a kiss. I mean, it's very just here's what happens. Until you hit sex, and then it's suddenly you're in like
– It's an operatic ballet.
Yeah, like it turns into like utter metaphor because, right. You know, they can't get too graphic, I guess, right? Or they weren't when I was there. So, but it was a phenomenal job, and it was still one of my favorite jobs ever because, you know, and I worked the night shift, of course, right? So I was working the night shift at the Love Factory.
So in other words, you've got material for cocktail parties for the rest of your life.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it was like I had just gone through a breakup when I got hired there, so I was just like absolutely miserable.
There's your memoir right there, The Night Shift at the Love Factory. That's right. I'd buy that in a hot minute. You actually left a really cool comment on the our post about Agnes and the Hitman, talking about or sort of addressing my issues with the lack or you know, the weird version of feminism that was in the book. So some people consider the way women in relationships are handled in these books to be kind of like it's an empowerment fantasy.
Yeah. And I mean, I had sort of the same reaction when I started reading these things, right. Where I was like, oh, good Lord. Like, it's just these conservative, you know, family values, you know, sort of amplifying the sort of norms. But when I went off to grad school, I left Harlequin and went to grad school, and I ended up writing about Harlequins. I actually published a couple of papers about them. And so I had to do a lot of research into them. And I came across these books, you know, these studies essentially where people were making arguments that Harlequins were in fact feminist texts. And their argument was that, sure, it's a, you know, it's the typical heteronormative relationship that's reaffirmed at the end of the book, but the power dynamic has changed so that the women actually have some agency and have the upper hand in the domestic sphere, right? So they're able to they come across the alpha male, and they're able to tame him and make that alpha male sort of obedient to them, or at least respect their desires. And so that's that the argument that's sort of it's less a feminist text. I mean, it's maybe not what we sort of normally associate with feminism. But it does, in fact, empower these women, and especially given who the readers of Harlequins normally are, who are, you know, often housewives and who are, you know, not employed, you know, they're stay-at-home moms or whatever.
Right. So it's less about changing the playing field than accepting the playing field, but then sort of changing the perspective so that you can kind of have your cake and eat it too.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.